You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everybody. I need a good morning back.
Good morning.
Good morning, teacher.
Yes, I am Professor Moon. That's my other life. It's mostly to wake me up. I need the, you know, resonance. My name is Kathy Moon, and I am the SK Korea Foundation Chair of Korea Studies here at Brookings. I'm very happy to see you all, and I apologize for our slightly late start, but we wanted to make sure there was a critical mass of people in the room so you don't miss any gem of intellectual, analytical value that will come from our first panel. This is the first Seoul Washington Forum that I have helped organize together with colleagues at the Center for East Asian Policy Studies here at Brookings, as well as the Korea Foundation. And it's been a big learning experience as well as a very exciting, inspirational journey. Made me think hard about how to frame and approach U.S.-Korea, U.S.-Asia, Korea-Asia-related issues in an interesting way. And what I tried really hard to do together with my colleagues at Brookings is to diversify the speakers, their perspectives, generations, all sorts of ways to involve more people and new voices. And hopefully we will be the beneficiaries of this collective effort. I'm very happy to say that this is, we believe, the largest ever RSVP'd audience, okay? For the Seoul Washington Forum. This is the seventh meeting, and I believe we have over 200 people who have RSVP'd, which is a record for us. And so we're very happy about that, and many people will be coming in and out throughout the day. The public portion of the event will start with the panel on ROK, Japan relations in the context of U.S. rebalance toward Asia. But before we open up, I'd just like to let you know that the procedure or format for this conference is a slightly different one from the ones you might be used to in Washington. We had asked each moderator, and the moderators were chosen very carefully. If you noticed, all three are women. They were tasked to be very tough, very organized, and very directed in terms of coordinating themes and coming up with analytical questions, concepts that need to be clarified, to point out areas of agreement, disagreement among the presenters, because we Americans, we like disagreement as long as we can come to some consensus later. And so we wanted to air out all sorts of opinions, and so the moderator's job is very important. They will open each panel with their own assessment of the panel's work pre-conference, pre-today. They've been emailing and working on this prior to today, and then share with us their findings and also discuss some of the areas that they've outlined for further research or for further debate or ways to inform policymakers in creative, constructive ways. So I thank the moderators very much for their leadership role in advance. Now, the real big thank you goes to the Korean delegation, who has traveled very far to join us. And so I thank all of the university professors, the excellent think tank analysts, and we have the president of the East Asia Institute, Dr. Suk-jung Lee, who is an alumna of Brookings as a visiting fellow. So we're happy to have you back. We will fight for you as ours, and maybe not the Korean teams, but you are truly Korean-American today. We also have members in our presentation group on both the U.S. and Korean side, also a representative from the private sector, Jay Ko. We want very much to include individuals and organizations that are not necessarily the usual suspects in Washington, at least on these analytical panels. We have also a former Republic of Korea National Assembly member, a very, very respected and I would say revered member, Dr. Park Jin. He is here. He's actually at the Wilson Center also as a fellow. He has been one of the most thoughtful Koreans I have ever engaged with in terms of U.S.-Korea, East Asia, and global issues. And we're very lucky to have you with us and shed some light. We also have two current members of the Korean National Assembly with us, Mr. Yoo Sung-min, right here, and Mr. Choi Jae-chun. And you will have occasions to speak with them, ask questions, et cetera, during various moments in the day. I very much want to thank the head of the Korea Foundation, President Yoo, President Dr. Yoo Hyun-suk, and also his staff. We have been working on this for months, and as you can imagine, it takes a lot of work to coordinate between two different time zones and two large organizational protocols, procedures, rules, and also interests. So it's very much a product. Today's a product of collaboration in the best sense of the word. Dr. Yoo will join me in welcoming you in a minute. And I also would like to thank my colleagues in the Center for East Asian Policy Studies. Are you here? Aileen Chang, Jennifer Mason, Aileen Chang, Paul Park. They're all out there, but I hope you will pat them on the back, on the shoulder, and give them a word of thanks, because this truly could not have occurred without them, and I mean that very literally. So thank you, and Dr. Yoo.
Thank you, Cathy. Good morning, everybody. My name is Hyun-suk Yoo, president of the Korea Foundation, the co-organizer of this Seoul Washington Forum. Unlike Cathy, I bring somewhat formal opening remarks, but fortunately very short. So it is my pleasure and honor to deliver the opening remarks for this 7th Seoul Washington Forum. In particular, I'd like to express my sincere gratitude for your participation in this meaningful gathering. This forum, which underscores the long-time partnership between the Brookings Institution and the Korea Foundation, would not be possible without the contribution of everybody here today. Since its launch in 2006, the Seoul Washington Forum has successfully served as a comprehensive dialogue channel for the discussion of the critical matters that affect the common interests of Korea and the U.S. I can tell you that the Seoul Washington Forum is amongst the most important and effective forum events that the Korea Foundation present in cooperation with its foreign partners. At this 7th Seoul Washington Forum, we'll discuss recent development in East Asian regional order and their overall impact on U.S. foreign policy. Recently, there have been several notable changes in and around the Korean Peninsula and East Asia. These include the emergence of various diplomatic controversies over past history that has clearly strained the relationship between Korea and Japan, along with other contentious regional security issues. Therefore, this situation calls for a critical assessment of these geopolitical and then strategic matters of East Asia within the context of Washington's pivot to Asia. In addition, the Korean government's effort to move toward the reunification of the two Koreas need to be readdressed in this forum. The unification of the Korean Peninsula represents a daunting challenge and huge opportunity in several regards. This forum is thus a timely opportunity to scrutinize the President Park's bonanza vision of reunification, as well as the obstacle that must be overcome for its realization. Another item of discussion is Korea's initiative to assume a more active role in relevant global issues, especially in regard to such matters as green economy and climate change. With environmental concerns being one of the most critical issues of our time, the potential contribution of Korea's latest technology in this area are of vital importance to the global community. Overall, I look forward to yet another productive outcome from this meaningful gathering of such distinguished policymakers and the specialists of the U.S. and Korea. Hopefully, this event might serve as a catalyst to broaden your perspective of critical trans-Pacific issue and help to fortify the intellectual network of our two countries and peoples. Finally, I'd like to again express my sincere gratitude and appreciation to the Brookings Institution and especially Dr. Kathy Moon for co-hosting this event and preparation of this wonderful, meaningful gathering. Thank you very much.
May I just ask that you, God forbid, turn off your smart everythings if you have the self-discipline, because all of these people deserve your undivided attention. If you don't have that discipline or have urgent matters, then please put them on vibrate so that we don't disturb our panelists. Thank you.
So without further ado, I think we will begin the first panel. Good morning, everybody. My name is Sheila Smith, and I'm a senior fellow for Japan Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. I'd like to thank Dr. Moon and Dr. Yu for convening the forum, of course, but also for inviting me to participate in this morning's conversation. As Kathy pointed out at the start, we have been given a fairly strict orders on how to proceed, and I will try to be faithful to Kathy's intent. I think, you know, my own background has been focused on the linkage between domestic politics and foreign policy choices. And I have been watching East Asia for many years now, more than I'd probably care to say. But I had the great pleasure of working with Kathy on a project that I led, a collaborative project on the U.S. military presence in Asia, almost a decade ago. And with Kathy's guidance, we visited South Korea. We also visited the Philippines, as well as Okinawa, Japan. And I think all of us in that project came away with a very keen set of convictions, some of which we had before we started, but were really reinforced. And that is that unless we understand the domestic political context of the debates over strategic choices, unless we understand the currents that will shape leaders in the countries of East Asia, we can't really have a serious conversation about policymaking. It can't all be led from the top of governments, nor can it all be led from Washington, D.C. Right? So I hope in the context of our conversation in the first panel, but also throughout the rest of your day, that nexus between domestic political change and strategic change is a part of your thematic. I think it's always useful when we talk about geostrategic change to take a step back from East Asia. We are, and I think nobody in this room, but raise your hand if you disagree, everybody recognizes that we are in an era of particularly conspicuous geostrategic change. Asia Pacific's rise as the core of the global economy, I think, is transformative in and of itself. And within that, of course, China's rise, the lifting of millions of people in Asia out of poverty, right, has also created some interesting political currents in the Asia Pacific. But they are not just about Asia. I got up this morning to watch the news, and the first thing at the top of the news was the Scottish independence vote, right? These are political transformations that are not particular to Asia. We're watching them develop in Europe. We're watching that with the secession, the annexation, rather, of Crimea. We're watching it around the globe, and I think it's very hard to have one concept, one idea that captures all of these transformations at once, but I think it's a particularly widespread sense that we need some new frameworks for trying to understand our collective action. And that collective action is as important as it is in the alliances, as well as the regional multilateral institutions and global institutions, both economic and political. So our policymakers, I think, around the capitals are really grappling with a very complex world. And it's not just that it's a moment of change. It is not that we can't quite understand if it's the change we are seeing in front of us or the change that we are anticipating that's really going to fundamentally challenge these alliances in East Asia. So that's my very brief sense of the difficulties, and I sense them in Seoul, I sense them in Tokyo. I certainly know that our policymakers here are having a very hard time managing relationships that for a long time have seemed fairly stable and very day-to-day and very kind of tied into existing networks of bureaucrats and politicians. But today I think the citizens and the broader groups around society are calling some of those compacts into question. So at the end of this morning session, I hope we're going to come right back to the policy context to ask, how do we design alliance relationships for this era of geostrategic change? Can we redesign our security strategic cooperation in a way that encompasses all of these complex political dynamics? Now, I read the papers. They're excellent papers, and you have a group of excellent speakers this morning. I have some questions, but I thought we would give them just a few minutes at the start to talk about how they have approached this question of strategic change. They have each done it actually quite differently in each of their papers. Some are worried and see risk. Some see opportunities. It may not surprise you that the sole economist on our panel is more inclined to see opportunity than risk. But I hope we'll flesh that out a little bit after the panelists have a brief chance to introduce their remarks. If our Korean guests will forgive us, I'm going to start from my right. It's very impolite to start with the Americans first, but I'm going to start here on the Obama pivot, and we'll work our way down to your conversation about Japan and South Korea. So, Stacey, would you like to lead us off for a very brief introduction of your thoughts?
Sure. Thank you. And thanks to Kathy for inviting me to participate. I'm very honored to be here today. My remarks are going to center on the Pentagon's pivot or rebalancing towards East Asia, and in particular in Northeast Asia. And I just wanted to make a few observations about the rationale behind this initiative, some of the challenges that it has encountered in Northeast Asia, and then its future prospects. So starting with the rationale behind it, I think that the pivot was really motivated by the Obama administration and the United States' effort to maintain its current strategy of forward defense in the face of growing operational as well as political threats to its access in the Asia-Pacific region. But that you see that there's actually a bit of a divergence between these two geographically, and that in Southeast Asia, which has received the lion's share of attention, the United States is looking to expand its presence and is basically responding to China's growing military capabilities, and in particular its ability to hold U.S. forward-based forces at risk with its arsenal of precision-guided munitions. So you're seeing this expansion into Southeast Asia so the U.S. can better deal with China's growing assertiveness in the South China Sea, concerns about freedom of navigation in that region as well as the Indian Ocean, and the U.S. in response is trying to disperse its forces. There are some very small efforts maybe at hardening some of its facilities there so that they're less vulnerable to attack, and then also increasing its active defenses, mainly its missile defenses. And if you contrast that with Northeast Asia, most of the main initiatives that are considered to be a part of the pivot today actually predate it significantly, and they're contracting the United States' permanent military presence. And they're in response to the political threats to access, in particular the fact that there's been enduring and persistent domestic opposition to the U.S. military presence in South Korea as well as in Okinawa. And in response, the United States has been trying to find a way to lighten its footprint, as it likes to say, by reducing the forces that it has permanently based overseas and relying more on temporary rotations. So you have the two components in South Korea where the Yongsung relocation plan, moving the large army garrison out of the heart of Seoul, and the land partnership plan where the U.S. is consolidating, actually getting rid of nearly half of its facilities in South Korea and moving all of its forces to two very large hubs. And then with Okinawa, you see that there's the realignment of the Marine Corps by reducing, I think it's around 9,000 Marines now, moving them off of Okinawa to Guam, either Hawaii or Australia. So there's this fundamental distinction, I think, in terms of the motives of what has been subsumed under the pivot in terms of what's happening in Southeast Asia and Northeast Asia and the actual type of actions that the United States is taking. So the expansion that might be happening in Northeast Asia has really centered around the hope or the expectation that the U.S.'s two closest allies, South Korea and Japan, can actually cooperate more and strengthen their military cooperation. And there's been some difficulties encountered in trying to actually realize this objective. So I think when you look at the challenges that the pivot has faced in Northeast Asia, they're due primarily to three different factors. You have differing priorities among the allies, the United States, South Korea, and Japan. There are domestic political difficulties, and then there are budgetary constraints. So starting with the different priorities, if the United States and increasingly Japan have been focused on the threat posed by China, and that has led them to be more willing to take actions that China is not necessarily happy with, including things like developing an integrated ballistic missile defense system in Northeast Asia. By contrast, South Korea is still largely focused on the North Korean threat and sees a missile defense system as a very expensive and not necessarily effective way of countering the number of missiles that North Korea has aimed at it. So it's been more reluctant to get involved in this initiative, and that hasn't actually gone forward very well trilaterally yet. The U.S. and the Japanese are cooperating. In terms of domestic politics, some of the problems that have been encountered, getting back to what Sheila mentioned initially, is that the United States is trying to realign its forces in Korea and Japan, not just open new bases or close bases. And that's typically really difficult wherever it happens. We have trouble within the United States with the last BRAC, caused all kinds of difficulties and cost overruns. And these same problems have plagued both of the efforts in Korea and in Japan and have led to delays. So you find that this process is taking much longer. It looks like Korea is actually moving forward. They're saying 2017 now for the completion. Okinawa and closing Futenma, they're still looking at 2022, though I did see this morning that the Japanese government came out and asked that they're going to push for the U.S. to actually close it by 2019. But we'll see whether that actually happens. And then you have the territorial and the historic disputes between Korea and Japan, which has obviously been an impediment to growing cooperation between them. The fact that they don't necessarily trust each other and that they still have this outstanding island dispute has certainly prevented deepening cooperation. It helped to undermine the military intelligence sharing agreement that was on the table in 2012 and seems to be resurfacing in a slightly different form these days. The final issue is just budgets and financing the pivot and who's going to actually pay the cost of this. The United States is increasingly looking to its allies to share a greater amount of the burden. And South Korea and Japan are already at the forefront of this. They, in terms of providing host nation support, subsidizing the U.S. military presence in both these countries. But you're seeing that there's tension and pressure within Congress for this to increase even more, and that this could be a problem. Even more importantly, I think, is the issue that because the United States is facing these mandatory spending limits imposed by the Budget Control Act for the next decade, there are questions whether the U.S. can actually implement the pivot and create a politically and operationally resilient posture. Does it have the money to actually follow through on this policy? And that's manifested itself in some of the concerns about abandonment, and in particular with South Korea, the reluctance, I think, to go through with the OPCON transfer, delaying the transfer of wartime operational control of Korean forces, again, I think is in part due to this fear that the United States may actually just pull out if it's given the chance. So that's rather bleak. I don't actually think it's entirely awful. You see that the pivot is moving forward in terms of the realignment, especially in Korea, though there are some outstanding issues about whether some U.S. troops are going to remain near the demilitarized zone, and there's been some recent disagreement between the U.S. and the South Korean government on that, and other issues. As far as trilateral cooperation, it seems...
Can you hold on the trilat piece?
Sure.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we'll come back to that at the end of the panel.
Sounds good.
Is that all right? We'll come back to the prescriptions at the end.
You'll have to forgive me also. I was so anxious to get into the conversation that I forgot to introduce Stacy Pettijohn from the RAND Corporation. And I think you have in the handouts, you have the bios of all of your speakers. So forgive me for my enthusiasm. Our second speaker is Gary Helfbauer from the Peterson Institute. And Gary, your paper was strikingly different in tone, in large part because you are talking about trade and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, among other things. So I wonder if you could share with us your sense of the opportunities afoot.
Thanks, Sheila. And I want to start by thanking Catherine and the Brookings Institution and the Korea Foundation for inviting me. Well, it won't surprise you when I tell you that as economists, we think that the world is best and countries are best when people who want to get rich are running the country, to be very crass about it, not military people. And military people tend to be hostile to one another. That's their business. Businessmen, people who want to make money, they tend to see opportunities with each other. And as an economist, and a specialist in international economics, I see the trade investment lens as a way of furthering cooperation between countries. And I take the view, not only in East Asia, but more generally, that trade agreements in the post-war, post-Second World War period have had a large liberalization component. There are some scholars who think that they basically codify what countries have already decided to do internally, and there is a codification element. But I think there's a huge liberalization component, which then leads to the growth of trade and investment internationally, which is one of the great positive glues in the global economy and has contributed enormously to world prosperity in the last 60 or 70 years. So before going on in that happy theme, I do want to recognize and acknowledge what the Pew Foundation, which has just done a big poll, has reported. We had a meeting yesterday at the Peterson Institute and had a summary of that. I won't go into any detail. Americans certainly know that there's a sour attitude towards trade in this country amongst the population at large. Many people think it decreases wages, kills jobs. So that's not new news. But in Korea, and this poll covered 40 countries, it's worth looking at if you're interested in it. In Korea, there's a more optimistic attitude towards job creation, which is to say half the people think that trade creates jobs as opposed to in the U.S., 20%. But notably in Korea, there's quite a hostility to investment, inward investment, especially M&A, mergers and acquisitions. Same in Japan. So a pretty protective attitude towards an element of the international economy, which is critical for the kind of glue I'm seeing. And that has to be discouraging. However, the however on this is that in the United States, trade on when we come to an election is always way down at the bottom, like a number 10 issue. And I don't know in Korea, because I just don't know in Korea. And Japan is probably a somewhat higher issue, but it's generally low compared to other issues in most countries, according to the Pew reports that I heard yesterday. So what that means is that politicians can do the right thing and get people to eat their spinach. Let me come to the spinach. For Northeast Asia, particularly for Japan and Korea and also the United States, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is the centerpiece. This is going to be the trade glue of the next decade. If it comes about, I'm optimistic. And I have some statistics in my paper for Korea. The payoff, according to a model that we commissioned, is about 2% of GDP. Now, I know 2% may sound small, but actually for government work, that's very big stuff. It goes on forever. If you were to discount it to the present value, it's a very big sum. For the U.S., it's less because of the size of our economy, but for Japan, it's also about 2%. Now, obviously, the big point on the TPP is this is the way for Japan and Korea to cooperate. Both in it, politically easier than a bilateral agreement, and could be a very positive thing. And we're thinking that Japan will join in the second tranche after TPP is ratified by the 12. That Korea will be in the second tranche and will be the leader of the second wave. Indonesia, possibly some other countries as well. In this kind of optimistic scenario, services liberalization is just critical. We all are highly restrictive on our services trade. It's difficult to estimate the size of barriers, but the most recent research done by a French institute says that in Japan, Korea, and the United States, the tariff equivalent of services barriers is about 45%. That is extremely high. That's higher than agriculture on average. There are peaks in agriculture, but on average, 45% is extremely high. There are a lot of restrictions on services. Services is between 60% and 75% of our economy. That's the future of liberalization. That's the future of economic growth, and it goes all the way from education, like we're talking today, to hospitals, to finance, obviously right across. Let me talk about just a couple of other possible trade agreements. There's the China-Japan-Korea agreement, which has been talked about, negotiated. I think one can be optimistic about the Korea-China leg. China's already the principal trading partner of Korea. There's a lot to agree on, so that may be a very positive thing. It's harder to see the Japan-China leg, and it's also hard to see the Korea-Japan leg. Much easier to see a TPP formulation than a Korea-Japan. But that's a possibility. One other agreement is kind of in the offing right now, and that's the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which all these countries are part of and many others as well. But our view is that that will be a very shallow political agreement, much more in the codification line than the liberalization line. So not a lot of push there, but maybe eases political things. Let me just wind up with just a brief comment on Korean unification, which has enormous, obviously, political and strategic and military implications. But there is an important economic question there, and that is whether, if and when there is unification, other countries which are part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I'm envisaging Korea will be part of, other countries will have equal access to economic opportunities in what is now North Korea as South Korean firms. That will be a big issue. Another very big issue, and these are future issues, is whether products from North Korea would, through these trade agreements, have equal access to the markets of, say, Australia, U.S., and so forth. You say, well, that's a no-brainer. Hey, that's a big brainer. Look at the problems with Vietnam on labor issues. And for North Korea, they would be in spades. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gary. Our third speaker on the panel this morning is Dr. Suk John Lee, who's the president of the East Asia Institute and professor at Sungkyu Kwan University. Dr. Lee.
Thank you, Sheila. It's good to be here on Mass Avenue around the Dupong Soko, and I'm meeting old friends and new friends. And actually, you know, I thought I was asked to write about the Korea-Japan relations and the role of the U.S., but that specific question was couched in the U.S. rebalancing to Asia. So I feel like I strongly feel like I have to mention something about this. And also my 4 pages memos and talking points are not out there and circulated only among the only present presenters. Let me respond to the U.S. pivot to Asia, how it is creating a dilemma to South Korea. I guess many Koreans understand that the U.S. pivot to Asia is motivated by trying to maintain its presence toward the rising China. And so therefore, and at the same time, there is a kind of declining resource power of the USA. So there is a kind of rising demand to share the military defense capability among allies in Asia Pacific. In that matter, Korea kind of has a kind of complex reaction to this. South Korea is basically welcoming to this rebalancing because we interpret this as an American strong commitment to the defense of South Korea from the all potential threat from North Korea. So it's good for the security commitment to the peninsula. On the other hand, because this U.S. pivoting to Asia is motivated with the U.S.-American concern about China, and Korea is in dilemma because obviously the Korean position is that China is an important political partner to Korea, and we believe having a good relationships with China is good for the peace in Northeast Asia in general and also good for the USA in the long run. And so in that matter, we have a quite different reaction compared to the Japanese reaction. A Japanese interpretation of U.S. rebalancing to Asia, and they are using more like strengthening the Japanese military capability using this opportunity because Japan thought China threat more seriously compared to, obviously, to South Korea. So that is related to something I'm going to talk about, how the American can play a role in this bilateral relationship between important two allies, Korea and Japan. When I meet the American friends, they are saying, we worry about more about the deteriorating relationship between two allies, Korea and Japan, rather than the problem posed by North Korea. So I understand the American position because having a good relationship between two allies, very critical allies in Asia Pacific is very important to the success of U.S. rebalancing to Asia Pacific. But however, you know, there are serious challenges in this bilateral relations. Actually, when I'm thinking about this worsening Korea-Japan relations, I'm still debating, is it matter of Abe government with the current Korean government, or is it going to be continuous pattern? And we remember the Japanese government of Hatoyama cabinet, for example, he suggested the idea of East Asian community. So therefore, maybe this Abe cabinet's policy trying to kind of alienate Korea can be very, leave only under his government. But at the same time, if I see a kind of a very spreading, the rightist sentiments and elements in significant portion of Japanese civil society, and especially Japanese politicians, I'm worried about this pattern. Maybe they can be succeeded by another conservative government in the future. So for that matter, I think Washington should worry about this potential conflict between two important allies in Asia Pacific. And here, I guess, what can you do? There are typically history matters, and you may wonder, Korea and Japan had historical problems in the past, then why it matters that much at this point? That's important, right? Typically, we have three big issues about the past history between Korea and Japan. The Koreans are usually taking this Japan's textbook history issues because whitewashing the history issues, and also the comfort woman issue we call sex slavers today, and also Tokto Takeshima territorial disputes. And Korean side tend to take this territorial issue as a historical issues. On the other hand, Japanese is approaching this issue as a legalistic approach. So there is a huge dimension on this one. I think for the USA, there is not much things that the United States can do about this Tokto Takeshima issue. However, I think in history matters, there is a large room for the U.S. to play. For example, when we discuss history issues, there are two theories. Some people say it is better separate historical issues from the security cooperation, because security cooperation between Korea and Japan through the common ally USA is very important and is well shared by Korean leaders and Korean opinion leaders, and also Japanese leaders and Japanese opinion leaders and politicians. But nevertheless, it's not easy to separate these issues in theory, because in reality, they are not separable. Because it's not only due to the mistrust among important politicians, and also that issue is somehow related to securities issues. So therefore, we have to address that issue, and I guess the American side should, in my opinion, should put some red line, so the quote-unquote the revisionist history attempted by the Japanese right-wing groups cannot surpass certain limit, then what kind of limit? I guess, for example, the Abe government attempt to nullify the Kono statement made in 1993, I think that I understand America, Washington played a very subtle, nuanced role in discouraging this kind of the nullifying efforts of the Kono statement. So there must be a continuous effort for this, because America is a stakeholder in the post-war Japan history, including the peace constitution. So therefore, it's important. And also, continuous discouragement about the Japanese Prime Minister, the visit to Yasukuni Shrine. And also, next year, Japan is going to memorize the 17th year of ending the World War II. So we expect Prime Minister Abe is going to replace with his statement the Murayama statement done by 1994. So we better watch how Abe's new statement is gonna, coloring this two important documents. And second issue the U.S. should play is about the Japanese right to collective security. Collective security, and of course, Japanese government love to use the UN, United Nations, right, any government to defend their own territory and also to join this collective security. So legally, of course, Japan has a full right. But however, the Koreans worry because this sufficient procedural efforts from the Japanese side to seek the Korean understanding. So far, our official position about this issue is that if there is some contingency in the Korean Peninsula, if the Japanese the military wants to support the U.S. FK in Korean Peninsula, they need to seek the Korean government approval first. So actually, they are putting more conditionality, worrying about this procedure aspect. But you know, if that kind of thing happens in substantive matter, how can Korea oppose the Japanese support of U.S. forces in Korea? So it's a more procedural matter, but we see the Japanese government haven't tried enough to get the understanding of the Korean side. And in addition to this, I think many Koreans worry about this collective security right can create the tension with regard to Japanese Chinese reaction to this. So there is a concern about this kind of tipping more lively and tensions between China and Japan. And South Korea is definitely trying to define kind of middle power role to ease the tension. Okay, for that matter, I guess if Japan is not doing up, I think the U.S. Should try to persuade or to put it in a better framework. So the Japanese right to collective security can serve the stability and peace in Northeast Asian region. That's it. Thanks.
Terrific. Thank you, Professor Lee. And our last but certainly not least speaker is Jiwan Huang, who's a professor at the University of Seoul. Professor Huang?
Thank you, Shelley. Thank you for having me here, and I'm really glad to have a chance to speak about the U.S., Korea, and Japan, the triangle issues. Actually, as the Stacey said before, that the Koreans believe that the Obama administration, U.S., the rebalancing and the pivot to Asia is a response, natural response to the rise of China. So it is why the United States makes every effort to strengthen the triangle with the South Korea and Japan. In order to strategically cooperate with the rise of China in Northeast Asia, strengthening the strategic triangle U.S., Korea, Japan triangle is very important. However, it's not easy also because of the deadlock of relations between Korea and Japan. So the problem is not is located in the outside, but the problem is inside, in the especially the between the Korea and Japan. So as you know, that the South Korea and Japan are geographically very close, but you know we always say that mentally far from each other. So it's because of there are the historical and emotional relationship. The Korean-Japanese relations, you know, have continuously suffered from mutual distrust and the friction. So, because of the strong, you know, U.S. Commitment, security commitment, and economic commitment to East Asia, so the South Korea, Japan could sustain security link with the United States. But the Korea, Japan have never formed the substantial bilateral security alliance. Some people say it's a pseudo alliance, but never had formed a bilateral security alliance. So rather, we have the Korea, Japan have shared common the security perspective, you know, with more with the United States than with the each other. So, but you know, we share the common the military and political, you know, threat. And from the former Soviet Union during the Cold War era, and China, and North Korea. But so both South Korea and Japan have related to each other, I think, largely through the United States. There's still just the bilateral relations, but the United States has, you know, plays a very critical role in the linking two countries. So this may be looked very strange from the American point of view, because you know that South Korea, Japan is, you know, geographically very close. But so such an unstable, you know, relations between the two countries and, you know, serious the perception gap that reflect the historical issue, the colonial legacy, and the emotions which differ from those to be, I think, expected in the West. So historical antagonism against Japan in South Korea has become so deeply, you know, embedded in the Korean society and still, you know, passed down to the generation to generation through media and history education, that anti-Japanese sentiment has, you know, characterized the major part of the Korean national the identity and nationalism. So, but the problem is that now the United States tried to separate the history issue, such as the comfort women, sex slavery issue, from the other, you know, agendas such as security or diplomatic ones. But the thing is that the history, domestic politics, and foreign policies are still, you know, intertwined each other. So history issue still has a, you know, the great impact on the both in Korean, Japanese domestic politics and foreign policy. So regarding the America's the rebalancing strategy in East Asia, such as the unstable relationship may raise a very, very pessimistic prediction about U.S., Korea, Japan security triangle in the future, especially in consideration of the rise of China, as I said. There may be continuously a strong tendency for South Korea and Japan to depend on the United States as an outsider, you know, arbiter or the mediator, but the strategic cooperation so is still that. The economic cooperation and other issues, cooperation in the other areas are not very, very difficult, but you know, in the security issue, it's not really easy, you know, difficult issue. So, but you know, the thing is that because the United States tried to shift the burden of balancing Chinese power to an East Asian regional the alliance, that is to South Korea and Japan. So one of the best options for the United States, the rebalancing and the pivot to Asia policy would be a trilateral, you know, the security triangle. But however, it is not clear whether the South Korea and Japan will be willing to pursue substantial security cooperation. We can see this situation in the case of GSOMNIA, security intelligence sharing cooperation between South Korea and Japan, but it failed to have such kind of the agreement. So if Korean Japanese security cooperation seems less likely than continued, maybe both countries made effort to focus on the internal balancing rather than the external balancing in Northeast Asia. So maybe the pessimistic future for East Asian security could be the predictive. So the South Koreans have always shown is the concern about the Japanese rearmament, and the Japan also that the complaint about the South Korea's the anti-Japanese sentiment. But if this situation continues before South Korea and Japan achieve better mutual the understanding, the region will become a much more dangerous neighborhood. So more stable relations will come only when Japan is able to truly confront its past, its history, and also South Korea also should be encouraged to face the future rather than the history issue. So U.S., Korea, Japan triangle, depends largely on Korea-Japan security the cooperation, and this bilateral relationship will be mostly, I think, the functional or psychological factors such as historical antagonism and the emotional relations which have prevailed for almost a century. So the history issue, some kind of emotional issue, and the national identity has a great impact on the both Korean, Japanese, the domestic politics, and also the foreign policy. So I said this, they are entwined to each other and the strong impact in this area. So Koreans are also concerned about the unification issues. The Koreans are not really sure whether the United States, both United States and Japan, will strongly support the unification of the Korean people, just in case something happens in the North Korean regime. So South Koreans are also uncertain whether Japan will be persuaded, even if the United States chooses to support the Korean unification in the near future, maybe the early unification. Japan appears to disagree to the scenario of Korean unification because of the destabilizing factors that the Korean unification may cause. So Japan appears to be seriously concerned about whether unified Korea will move close to maybe to China, and even with the alliance with the United States. But the South Korea's, the main project, current main project is how to harmonize the Korea's, the alliance with the United States, strong alliance with the United States, and also with the South Korea's partnership with China. So Japan's a little somewhat, concerned about the situation. Maybe it's because it will give the Japan or the serious strategy, challenge. So maybe in this sense, it's very necessary to address such concerns about the relations between Korea and Japan. And as I said, United States, in this sense, the United States is really important for the last 60 years, 70 years. Maybe the United, the U.S. policy was, you know, give great, you know, impact on the relations and Korea and Japan, and also the security situation in Northeast Asia. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Four very thoughtful presentations. I think that we can all hear the similar kinds of sort of disconnects in terms of the perception of what the challenges are ahead. I think it's very clear that when you're sitting in Washington thinking either about the military or the economic dimensions of U.S. policy in the region, that the rise of China, the complexities of dealing with the integrative need or the need to integrate the countries of the region and the U.S. role in that has a very different resonance than obviously it does when you're sitting in Seoul and Tokyo. There are no Japanese participants on the panel, and perhaps it would be wise for me to play a little bit of devil's advocate. When I sit in Tokyo, it will not astound anybody in this audience that I hear a very similar refrain, and that is largely that we don't know how to deal with Seoul. We don't know what the right step forward is, why all of a sudden, I mean, these history issues, of course, the legacies of colonization, the legacies of the war have been with us throughout the post-war period, but we don't understand why the intensity now. And I think it's quite easy to point the finger at Mr. Abe, to be quite frank. I mean, he's his own personal beliefs. He's never been hesitant about talking about post-war and his sense of Japan's future and Japan's identity, right? But I don't think it's quite fair, factually, because I think a lot of the tensions that really erupted, in fact, most recently, erupted under Madam Park's predecessor, Lee Myung-bak. And so when the Japanese go back to think about history and the current set of tensions in the relationship, they don't stop in 2012. They go a little bit earlier, right, before Mr. Abe came into power. All that being said, I wonder if, especially for our Korean participants, and again, we'll open this to the audience in a few minutes, but if you could share with me your insights into the domestic pressures and cleavages in South Korea that are presenting hurdles to some kind of bilateral dialogue between Japan and South Korea, I would be very happy to hear it, and I'm sure our audience would as well. For our two American participants, and I hate to break it out American and Korean that way, but I sense I'd like to push you a little bit further, both of you, on, as you look out at the region, the rise of China, it was implicit in both of your comments, I think, but the rise of China does produce new challenges for the United States, both in the economic and the strategic military domain. How much do you think American policy today is driven by the rise of China, and how much do you see China as a partner, a collaborator, with the United States in both TPP or economic discussions as well as our strategic effort to bring China in the region? You're welcome to comment on the Japan-Korea piece of the puzzle if you'd like, but if we could break it up in those two focal points, and I'll let our Korean colleagues go first this time, in large part because I made you wait till the end, but could you give us a sense, a little bit more of a sense of the texture in South Korea and what you think needs to happen by political leaders in both Seoul and Tokyo to move or to remedy the situation?
Okay. Because I've been following the public opinion in both countries, Japan and Korea. Actually, Japan-Korea, the mutual public perception had been improved a lot up to the late 2000s, especially after they co-hosted the World Cup. And also especially Japanese, the favorable perception of Koreans got improved a lot. So therefore, if you compare the recent 2-3 years of survey, you can see the contrast. So my observation is that the public opinion of two countries are strongly influenced by the two governments' relations. That's very certain if you look at the poll data. So, and if you ask the countries whether improving the bilateral relationship I think both Koreans and Japanese are saying it's very desirable to improve this important bilateral relations. But there is one important new phenomenon, especially among Japanese citizens. Usually, history matters. Japan was kind of aggressor, and Korea played this victim psychology. However, if you look at the recent data, the Japanese are saying we are very much tired of this apology, and also we don't like the Koreans criticizing Japan over this history issue and on. So there is a kind of a strong anti-Korean sentiment. And so the history issue became a kind of a double-edged sword, hurting both societies' opinion. So for that matter, I think there comes to be more reconciliation between two governments. Then you may say, then who started first? Mm-hmm. It was there, and then if it's a government fault, who started? I guess Japanese side, I like to say, Lee Myung-bak started, even though he started as a very pro-Japanese government. He just visited Tokyo Island and mentioned about a little bit about the emperor and so forth. So, but I think that's more like event-focused, the simple interpretations. However, if you look at the more deep changes, I think it's definitely Abe cabinet. Because he systematically kind of repackaging this official Japanese position about their past history, imperial history. Like, you know, as I mentioned, you know, he talked about once he's in power, he's going to make a new Abe statement to replace the Murayama statement. And also he attempted again to probe the Kono statement. So therefore, I will say, even though there is a kind of a, you know, some unfortunate misunderstanding, I think it's more fought by Abe cabinet. But I think there is a kind of their strategic thinking why they play in that way. You may think, isn't it stupid? Because, you know, it's better to have a good relationship with Korea, especially for the security and so forth. Why then they just so obsessed with the rewriting the history? I think there is a not only ideological side, there is a kind of strategic side, and they tend to quite complacent as long as they got the USA, and I think the playing down the South Korean reaction very lightly. And that is creating antagonism in Seoul. And how we can improve, I guess civic diplomacy will be important. So I'm one of Koreans who is you know, organizing network, direct contact between citizens and citizens. And they are more easy to talk.
Thank you. Professor Huang?
Yeah. You know, what is interesting is that there has been some pattern of relations between Korea and Japan for the last four or five, the Korean government. During the, also in the Kim Il-sung government and Kim Dae-jung government and Nomuyen government and also the Lee Myung-bak government, the Korean president has only 5 years. And then during the first 2 or 3 years, the Korean government tried to, every Korean government, you know, has tried to make every effort to improve the relations with Japan. So, but, you know, actually the Japanese domestic politics does not respond in a very seriously. But so the South Korea's, such a kind of, you know, the policy in the South Korean government is not so sustainable. So the South Korea, you know, For the first 2 or 3 years, the South Korean government keep, you know, trying to change the relations pattern of relations, but it eventually turned out to be a failure. So the problem is that it seems to everyone that the history, you know, directly leads to the foreign policy, the Korea's policy towards Japan and Japan's foreign policy towards South Korea. But actually the domestic politics is, you know, between the history and the foreign policy, I think. So if the both countries, the Korea and Japan's domestic politics is not really in the fundamentally changes there, you know, we will see the another problem in the future. So I said that the history, domestic politics, and foreign policy are still intertwined. So.
Thank you very much. Again, when you talk to people inside Japan who are working on the relationship, on the bilateral relationship within the Japanese government, I think you have a real sense of urgency to the diplomacy itself. I think the broader factors that you're outlining here in terms of Japanese politics are quite accurate. But I also sense that the new court cases in South Korea, the role that the court is playing in terms of some of these historical legacy issues and compensation issues are also something for both governments that I think is a much more complex source of pressure than has been in the past. And as we approach next year, it's not just the 70th anniversary of the end of the war, it's also the 50th anniversary of the conclusion of the bilateral peace treaty. And I know for many who are working in the foreign policy arena in Tokyo, this is something that's very worrisome. And whether or not there will be some reopening of the discussion of the treaty, how to get over these different avenues of advocacy, both in both sides of the country, and right. both countries, both sides of the debate, I think for the diplomats and for the political leaders in both countries is going to be very challenging. I want to get to the point where we invite the audience in, so forgive me if I move on to the next question, which is, from the Washington's perspective, or at least from the United States' perspective, in terms of the two policy initiatives, the rebalance, the military rebalance, and the trade agenda that hopefully will be successful, given our own politics, where do you see, A, the alliances, but also China? Is it possible that we can craft a future economic partnership or a military strategic partnership with Beijing? And if so, what is it going to look like in the future? Stacey, would you like to go first?
Sure. I think that the military rebalance has clearly been driven by the China's military modernization and its rise. It's the first time in several decades that the United States military has faced a near peer competitor that has seriously challenged its military supremacy. It's found ways, it's identified U.S. Vulnerabilities and is seeking to exploit these. And then this fear has been compounded by the fact Chinese behavior really since about 2008, where it's been increasingly willing to assert its claims to disputed territories in the East and South China Sea, which seems to confirm that there is some cause for concern and that the United States needs to strengthen deterrence within East Asia to ensure that conflict does not break out. And that requires building upon the U.S.'s strong alliances with both South Korea and Japan, and also expanding its relationships and strengthening them with other countries within the region. So as far as collaborating with China, I think that there are certainly initiatives to try to build trust and to include China whenever possible, though it has been somewhat of a reluctant partner and has not always proven to act in good faith. China just recently, for the first time, participated in the big naval exercise RIMPAC held out in Hawaii, and that was a fairly big deal, but it also sent out a ship that was gathering military intelligence and collecting that not only probably on U.S. vessels, but on all of the participants, and that seemed to not suggest that it was participating in good faith and really trying to build relationships, but it was seeing this as an opportunity where it could gather more information that it could potentially exploit in the future. Mm-hmm. So there are certainly high mill-to-mill exchanges, and there I would expect those to continue and to, whenever possible, try to incorporate China into more of the multilateral initiatives, probably more so than bilaterally.
Let me just follow on something that both Professor Lee and Professor Huang raised, and that is that there is a certain discomfort in South Korea about this idea of containing China, of being so explicit in thinking about the alliances as instruments of containing China. Do you see the military rebalance as a kind of East Asian balancing? I think Professor Wang was your terminology. Is this what the pivot is all about in your mind in terms of the military ambitions of the pivot? Are we trying to create an East Asian balancer against China?
I don't think it's put explicitly as balancing. I think it's put in a cast in a much different light in terms of stabilizing the region and making sure that the current status quo order is not changed by the use of force, and that requires strengthening deterrence and increasing the U.S. and its allies' capabilities to be able to effectively respond to any military challenge, whether it comes from China or North Korea. But I think North Korea is often considered a lesser included case from the U.S. perspective.
Great, thank you. And Gary, I wonder if you could, you did a very good job of outlining the various trade collectivities, if you will, but the opportunities for trade expansion and trade liberalization. Where do you see China factoring in here in terms of the way in which you set the priorities for the region and the benefits that you outlined?
Well, Sheila, you put me on a panel here with a lot of Darth Vaders.
So I want you to save us from the dark side.
So you know, I'm going to try to give a little optimism, but we're not on cloud nine. We are realistic. So let me start with the realism. The realism is that there is bound to be long-term geopolitical conflict between the United States and China. And, you know, the Southeast China Sea, Taiwan, it's going to go on for the lifetime of the older people in this room, but also I think many of the younger people in this room. That's part of life. The point is to contain that part of life, recognize it's there, but not have it totally dominate the relationship between the United States and China. So that's where economics comes in. And as everyone in this room is aware, I think, the multinational corporations are very much in favor of a good economic relationship with China. But also, I've spent time in China. I don't pretend to be a China expert. But the business firms there are very interested in a strong relationship with the United States. They're very interested in TPP. We have a bilateral investment treaty. There are a lot of things going on. China and Canada just signed an investment protection agreement. Many constructive things are going on, and I think it is just possible. There is no historical precedent, but it's just possible that we will have a fairly strong economic engagement because China, after all, is foremost a capitalist country. There's no doubt it is a capitalist country. You know, this communist rhetoric, but that's the reality is it's a capitalist country. They're very internationally engaged in the economy, trade, investment, and more so in the future. And we hope that side of the economy is dominant, which it has been so far. And so there's a lot of opportunity for constructive engagement on the economic side. But just turning to history, you have to go back to the 19th century when there was a famous treaty between France and Britain to find anything that conceivably replicates or is a precedent for this notion of economic cooperation, Sykes-Picot Treaty, between two rivals. Political rivals, and that treaty lasted about 15 years. But if you look at the German-British relationship prior to the First World War, while there's quite a bit of trade and investment, there were no treaty arrangements between them. So what we're envisaging is something which is quite different than at least the historical precedents for the last couple hundred years. Let me briefly talk about Japan. China. There's a huge Japanese economic interest in China. The amount of investment far exceeds U.S. investment in China, at least direct U.S. investment in China. The Japanese companies are very happy doing business there, and of course they have a big interest in a good relationship, and I think the Chinese companies going the other way into Japan. So that's actually quite strong, but obviously the geopolitical tension is high and not going down. I want to, though, toss in a little realism to my Darth Vader folk here. The Korea China relationship. There is no geopolitical conflict. Let's be straight about this. Now, there's all the history, and everybody in the room knows the history better than I, and all the bad things that were done back and forth, and the colonization and so forth. Today, the fact of the matter is that U.S. and Japan, we have a geopolitical joint concern about China, which is not shared by Korea, to my view. Korea has no real tension with China, and it needs China as a collaborator in any unification effort. So there's a very different perspective going forward, and I've already spoken to the China-Korea economic relationship, which is already quite strong, both in investment and in trade, and will only grow stronger. So that's how I see the world, but what I want is the people who want to get rich to be in charge in all three countries, all four countries.
Thank you, Gary. So I promised I would open the floor at 10:30 sharp, which I will do, and I think what we'd like to do, we've got a great audience, a big audience, so I think there are microphones, is that correct? There will be people coming around with microphones. Raise your hand, be patient with me as I go around the room. There's many hands already. And I'm going to take two or three questions. So for our panelists, we'll get a few questions on the table, and then we'll come back and volunteer to answer. So I'm going to start at this side of the room with the lady right there in the blonde hair and the white shirt. Please stand up and wait for the mic and tell us who you are, please.
Hi, thank you for your talk today. My name is Nicole Stroner with the American Foreign Policy Council. And I have a question for the Korean side of our panel today. And it's in regards to the historical tensions that you guys have been touching upon. And in fact, with the youth of today and the whether it's intentional soft power in terms of the interactions that the new generation sees today in terms of studying abroad perhaps or more travel internationally between China, Korea, and Japan, is it possible that these historical tensions will be put aside in the future simply for the fact that there's more interaction between the younger generation and they seem to be kind of forgetting this tension? Thank you.
Great, thank you. Right in the middle, gentleman right there. Yes, please stand up forgive me for the pointing, but that's probably the best way for me to do it.
Absolutely, thank you, Sheila. Scott Harold from the RAND Corporation and a big fan of Star Wars. And having had my colleague described as a Darth Vader, I want to remind the audience that it was Darth Vader who saved the universe from the Emperor, who is truly evil. So, Dr. Huffbauer, if I may push you into that role, you have described your aspirations for the world as a place where the rich countries, the rich people, cooperate to run the countries. That's a very neoliberal U.S. view. However, the Chinese Communist Party runs China. It does not have a view that cooperation should be on a level playing field amongst people all trying to get rich, but rather a very linked view of the relationship between power, national power, and economic actors, all of which are state-owned enterprises, and I would very strongly contest your contention that that the capitalist portion of China is the leading portion. That's absolutely not the Communist Party's view. They don't ever want that to be the case. It would slip away from them. They do want to reform the economy. But I do want to push you on that, and I want to use that to segue to our Korean friends who I think have some pretty strong concerns about China that you mischaracterize when you say they don't have any. I think they actually have a lot, but their view is that they need China on the North Korea issue, and so they want to sublimate those concerns. Afterwards, however, there's a tremendous anxiety that North Korea is being bought up by China. And so I'd like to hear the Korean side talk a little bit about their concerns with respect to China, because I think that is part of the equation. Thank you.
Thank you. I was lenient with Scott to allow him two questions, but let's try one question at a time because there's a lot of people in the room and the young woman in the back here. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Sarah Koh. I'm actually a non-resident fellow for Korea Foundation of PAC Forum, CSIS. And I guess this question is open for all of our panelists today. So I'm wondering, does the U.S. want South Korea to choose ultimately between U.S. and China when it comes to cooperation? And if that's the case, what is the ROK's or the South Korea government's point on this, and how would they manage that?
So let me just clarify. You want the Americans to answer that question, and or would you like the perception, South Korean perceptions as part of the question too?
Yes.
Okay, so let's start there. I thought the first question was absolutely nice to focus us on the future, right, on the next generation. And so what about these historical tensions, and let's get over it so that younger people can study abroad and learn about the three societies of Northeast Asia in a much more constructive way. I'm going to start with Professor Huang, if you don't mind, from that end of the table.
Okay, so I don't represent the Koreans, the younger generation, but I think the...
Perhaps on the panel you might. How's that?
I'm the youngest here in this panel, so I think I have to...
Younger.
Okay. I have to respond to those questions. As I said that the Korean younger generation, is a little different, of course, but regarding to the Japanese issue and also the history issue, they are not so different actually. As I said that the history issue, historical antagonism, so deeply embedded in the Korean society and is still being passed down to the generation to generation, and the media has a very important role in the reproducing those kind of the sentiment, and also the history, the education is still the nationalistic also in China, also in Korea, but the soft power issue, the young generation, your generation, still we are talking much about the soft power issues, especially the Korean wave, Hallyu, and maybe the 소녀시대 or the Kara, Yonsama are very popular in the Japan, and also the Japanese comic books and the Japanese drama, which is called Ilde, Ilbon drama, Ilde, is very popular in Korea. Those kind of soft power has some influence on the Korean Japan relations, but in the cultural relations and maybe the economic relations, but I really hope that those kind of the soft power, the impact can lead to the better relations between Korea and Japan. But I think both the Korean and Japan is more likely to separate the cultural and the economic issue from the history issue and security issue, but something like that.
This does get us into this question of what the consequences of today's tensions are, really, not just for today, but for the future, right? And I think, you use the word reproducing those sentiments. And the question in my mind, and I hope, Professor Lee, you can speak to this in terms of the polling data that you've analyzed, is why reproduce them? What is the purpose of reproducing them? And I think both of you in your presentations talked about Korean identity is equivalent to anti-Japanese sentiment, or it is deeply wrapped up in a debate about who Koreans are today, right? Is that going to change, and should it change, I guess is my question. And on the Japanese side, you can ask very similar questions, which speaks to the question of the historical revisionism that is actually going on today in Japan. I would say it's not across the board in Japan, but there is certainly more interest in this reproducing of a different historical memory. And so you're talking about processes here that where people have choices to reproduce or not to reproduce. And Professor Lee, could you speak to that? Because I think it really gets to the heart of the question about why.
This issue of identity is very important to political scientists and IR theorists as well. I think, yes, it's true, the Korean identity, the part of important Korean identity is the strong independence from the Japanese colonial legacy and all these memories. So therefore, I don't deny there is a kind of anti-Japanese sentiments as a part of important pillar of a Korean identity, the modern identity. But at the same time, Korea is very much a globalized society. So many Koreans not only younger generation and also the middle-aged Koreans. They are very much liberal and globalized, much more so to equivalent generation of Japan. For example, you know, I have so many Korean students going abroad to study, not only to USA and to China, but less so to Japan. And the other way around is worse. Japanese students are not coming out to Japan or to China or to Korea, and even to the USA, I believe. So this is it's not a good tendency because I feel if you want to create this a good effect of more integrating and globalizing younger generation working for the peace and cooperation, they need the more deep knowledge and understanding of each other's history and culture. But they are usually looking at only K-pop and J-pop, but it doesn't translate it to a deeper understanding. And given that the historical education is not well done inside Japan, the majority of them, even though they like the K-pop, they don't have not much knowledge about the past history. So I worry about that. And from if I entertain the questions to the gentleman about the China threat, yes, the Koreans worry about the Chinese investment to mining industries and some key industries in North Korea, and that is one of the factors that the pro-engages asking our government and our leaders, we have to better engage in more with North Korea to facilitate the economic cooperation before North Korea's key industries are under the hands of China. And also another question about whether the Korea is perceiving whether we are pressed to choose one of two G2 important countries. Yes, I think so. There is pressure, but I guess our strategy is that we try to dilute that kind of situation of forced choice. And definitely for the security matter, the U.S. is the most important ally to Korea. There's no question about that before two Koreas are unified. So I guess our interest is to harmonize to this key ally relationship, how we accommodate and harmonize our interest having a good relationship with China.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Stacy to address that last question, too, about whether it's in the United States' interest to ask South Korea to choose. Are we asking South Koreans to choose? And if so, what do you think the answer will be?
I don't think the United States wants to have to choose itself. This is not the Cold War where your interests were neatly divided, economic and security aligned. Here it's a very different situation, and the United States is just, well, maybe not just, but very economically interdependent with China as well, and doesn't want to actually have a hostile relationship. At the same time, it doesn't want to encourage or allow there to be aggression within the region and, in particular, territorial expansion. So it has divergent interests and doesn't really have much it does not want to see different countries having to choose sides. Conversely, I think that China actually does want to push countries to pick sides and that it tries to exploit the historic hostilities between Korea and Japan and to inflame those tensions whenever possible and to make it difficult for its close economic partners to work with the United States by putting pressure on them, and at least publicly. And
thank you. I won't ask you to defend your honor as Darth Vader, but we will go to the Emperor, I believe. Gary, you're next. I mean, I think Scott's point about China, who China is today, and what its ambitions are in the economic realm, are just as germane as it is as they are in the strategic realm. So, how do you respond to that critique?
Well, I'm going to start with a correction on what I said earlier. It was the Cobden-Chevalier treaty between France and Britain in the 1870s. Just for historical correction, which is a slight precedent for what's happening today. Now, after that bit of modesty, let me first of all praise RAND, because I was on the one of the visitors of the RAND Graduate School back when Charlie Wolf was running it, and I have a great admiration for Rand, and that's the end of my nice remarks. The comment was completely wrong, completely misdescription of China today. And I urge you to read, when you have spare time, which I know you don't, the book which was just released this week by my colleague Nicholas Lardy, Markets Over Mao, and it is a very powerful description. China is a capitalist economy, as I said before. The state-owned enterprises are a very small share of the economy. They're about 20%. The direction has been absolutely clear. Price control is a very small part of the economy. And, of course, people can get extremely rich. Jack Ma is now the latest one, but in China. And, you know, it's just fine. So the notion that it's a state-run economy is just not correct. Now, what about the Communist Party? The Communist Party is interested in power. Yes, a monopoly of power, now and in the indefinite future. I agree on that, but it doesn't run through the kind of economic control that we associate with the former Soviet Union and some other countries of the past, including China before Deng Xiaoping. And you don't have to go any further probably than this room, but certainly this building. There are a lot of princes and princesses from China who are related to the standing committee, directly or indirectly, and they're going into economics, and they have a good start in life on that. I mean, that's the China. So I don't see the conflict which was described on the economic front. I do agree there's a monopoly of power, and the Communist Party is not about to give that up, and that does create anxiety here in the West. And how long we can live with that and the problems of that, that's another dimension. But it's not an economic contest in terms of the model.
Thank you. Chris Nelson, you had your hand up, and then we'll go back to the other parts of the room. Chris? Is it on, Chris? I'm sorry, we're not hearing you there. And let's remember that we should have one question apiece.
Can we? Okay, there I am. a suggested assignment for our RAND friends, probably a better model is Star Trek, not Star Wars, because the question on China is, you know, are these guys Klingons? You know, noisy, boisterous, they break stuff, but you can socialize and get along with them. Or are they the Borg? You know, so maybe Scott and Stacey can work on that and put out a joint paper. And I'm sort of serious. My question is, and a fascinating and yet incredibly depressing discussion of history. This is the third year now that, you know, we've all participated in this kind of discussion. And right at the start, the question was raised, what is the U.S. role here? Does the Obama administration need to adopt a more public and more proactive role in discussing and trying to contain the fantasy world that Abiy and the deniers live in? And the debate has been, well, it doesn't work if you're noisy and in public about it, versus if you're not noisy in public about it, A, the Koreans don't think you're serious, and B, Abiy just does whatever the hell he wants to do anyway. Abiy will do whatever he wants to do without strong public American pressure. So that's my question to the panel. Looking at what you see and looking at this unknowable debate, is this Abiy or is it now becoming institutionalized? Is it time now for the U.S. government to take a more active public role in constraining historical revisionism? Thank you. But I want to know about the Klingons, okay?
Do you have a question? Well, Kathy wants to ask a question. Sorry. You were waving at me. I couldn't quite figure out why. Please, go ahead.
Saying hello. I'm just going to take the liberty, since I put a lot of work into the coordination part, but it, frankly, I'd rather be up there with you guys thinking and talking. And I have a real question, but this is an answer to two of the questions or things you two of you threw out there. Dr. Lee did, as well as Sheila, Dr. Smith. The issue about the reality that the Korea-Japan historical tensions have been there a long time. Yes, we know that. The question, why has it become so intense in recent years, I think deserves an answer, or at least answers. And I think we have to keep in mind, and I hope the media in this room are taking notes. I'm a professor, so I ask people to take notes, but before taking notes, really think about what it is you're taking notes on. Because I think the media and all of us who are public educators, in a sense, have a moral responsibility as well as a practical responsibility to try to educate and enlighten our different readership, learnership, our audience. The bottom line is South Korea's democratization in the late 80s and the democratic fervor and institution building, but also with that in the 1990s, this passion for unleashing all sorts of questions and frustrations and pent-up anger and distress, both at the South Korean government as well as other governments, both historical and current in terms of issues. That is what happened in South Korea. In the 1990s were a time when NGOs, basically, you know, thousands of NGOs bloomed in the 1990s. You had a public, you had a free press, you had free media. People were able to ask questions that they had not been allowed to ask in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. One of those questions and one of those frustrations and dilemmas and pent-up curiosities, as well as the frustrations, had to do with history. So, yes, the issues have been there, but the reality that politics changed in South Korea, I think, needs to be remembered. It is not, as both Dr. Smith and Dr. Lee are saying, it is not just simply a Japan-created reality or just a Korea creative reality. It is both. But something happened in South Korea in the 1990s that the Japanese have to understand. The Japanese have a democracy. It started earlier, sooner than South Korea's. And South Korean democracy has been, in the 1990s onward, beating itself up. Not just beating up Japanese or beating up Chinese or beating up others regarding the history, but South Koreans have been beating themselves up over past wrongs, past confusions, past dilemmas. Not just the Japanese issue, but also who among the South Koreans were collaborators. So as many of you know, the witch hunt, including these pseudo-legal investigations into South Koreans whose, you know, uncle, great-grandfather had been a, quote, a collaborator, and then punishing current-day individuals who are not related to the historical past, I think is a problem that South Korea really has to grapple with. Because you can't have a unified society if you're going to constantly scare people about the past because somebody's going to dig it up, and then it gets related to Japan or America or somewhere else. The second reality is that South Korean political leaders need to take responsibility historically for some of these historical tensions with Japan that have been going on and on but have become exacerbated. Specifically, the Dokdo Takeshima issue was dealt with by both the Japanese and South Korean governments for many decades as simply a fisheries agreement issue. It was what Dr. Bong Yong-sik of Asan Institute called a material issue, not a political, diplomatic issue. It was under Prime Minister Ryutaro Hashimoto and President Kim Il-sung in South Korea. It was during that period when both political leaders used the Dokdo Takeshima issue for political gain domestically. So they should be held accountable. Political leaders need to be held accountable for how and why they manipulate and maneuver historical issues to become contemporary problems. Jeongsindae issue,
When the Cheongsinde sex slaves comfort women issue began to arise in the late 1980s and early 1990s through democratization, the South Korean government of Kim Il-sung, then later Kim Dae-jung, Noteu, Kim Il-sung, Kim Dae-jung, up to Lee Myung-bak, did not want to deal with the comfort women issue. You could talk to the comfort women activists themselves. They were so hurt by their own government that this issue was not being taken up by the government. When does it get taken up? By Lee Myung-bak. Why? For political gain. Personal and domestic political gain. And so we have absolutely clear answers to why these issues have become politicized. They're not just political, they become politicized. And I think that whether it's the media, academics, whoever, needs to be watching how these things happen and point to those, point to the sources that actually make these issues worse. My question goes to, this history issue is just, it's old. It's getting, you know, we're losing the taste of it. It's now become like part of this, you know, it's like clouds in the sky. We see them every day. Nobody knows how to deal with it. Nobody really cares how to deal with it, tell you the truth. We talk about how to care about finding remedies, and nobody's really putting forth efforts. And I think basic reality is to be honest with oneself. That means each society has to take responsibility. That includes Japanese as well as the Koreans. And political leaders have to take responsibility, including Abe, but also South Korean leaders. My question is regarding the so-called rebalance. American policymakers repeatedly try to tell us that the rebalance is not just about strategic military issues, but economic issues as well. That it's a total package. It's not a two separate policy deal. It's one policy package. It often gets forgotten. So the economic side is supposed to be the facilitator, in a sense, to make some of these harder, difficult issues move along a little bit better. So that's one thing. It related to that is that Koreans had hoped that with the rebalance might come some new and fresh attention to the North Korea issue in the context of rebalancing, both economically and politically. Not all Koreans, but some. They've said so. What I'd like to know from Dr. Hwang as well as Dr. Huffbauer is, where does North Korea fit in the, or where should it fit in the rebalance approach? Because right now it doesn't have a place. And Dr. Huffbauer, you alluded to this, that there are issues that need to be resolved. So if you could address that, the North Korea question in the context of rebalance, both economically and politically, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
So I think we'll have one more. That was a big set of questions and comments, but one more, and we'll come on this side. And there's a gentleman back there who's been waiting right by underneath the television. So we'll address him, and then we'll come back. Is the button on? Maybe another mic?
It's working. I'm Yi Kwan-sung from Sungkyunkwan University, the one she teaches at. I don't really have a question. I just wanted to give an additional comment on the first question about the younger generation's...
Younger generation?
I may be able to represent better for the younger generation. As far as I know, there's an engraving that goes, "We shall forgive, but never forget." I mean, my grandmother, who was born in 1929 and who is still alive, was almost taken to Japanese Imperial Army as a sex slave when she was 15. So it's not a history that's too far ago. And I know that many young generation in China, Japan, Korea are not paying too much attention about history nowadays, but that is why it is all the more important that we have to give proper, right history education to all these three countries. And personally, to give a brief background of myself, since you mentioned the global younger generation, I went to I went to international school in Burma for 4 years and currently doing a defense intern at Cato Institute. So personally, I have a lot of Chinese and Japanese friends who are quite close with me. And I don't have any personal antagonism toward my friends. My antagonism is toward the wrong education policies and failing unsuccessful corresponding responses to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, so what do we do? Let's go to Kathy's question first, because the history is going to be a big part of the conversation. But let's start on the very specific issue that Kathy asked Gary and Professor Huang to identify or to talk about, which is, where is North Korea in all of this? How do we understand North Korea's place both economically but also politically in a future Asia? Dr. Huang, would you like to go first?
So everyone understands that the U.S., the rebalancing and pivot to Asia policies or response or the rise of China, but the Northeast Asian countries, both Japan and South Korea, shared that it's really important that we welcome the U.S. Rebalancing and pivot to Asia, although I'm still suspect that the United States is still really the rebalance to and people to East Asia still, the Ukraine issue and also the Middle Eastern issues are important. And the thing is that North Korean issue is really important. So we, South Korean government and we, Korean people, try to think much about the importance of pivot to Asia regarding the North Korea, especially the unification issues. So if the United States, think much about the meaning of the importance of Northeast Asia, especially the Korean Peninsula. But I think that the U.S. needs to resolve these old issues still. Not only the history issue, but also the North Korean issues are old. So it's really important to the how to understand how to cope with the North Korean issue and how we will delete the North Korean issue. Resolving the North Korean issue will lead to the unification issues, but still, the problem project is that we don't know exactly how to connect this kind of the rebalancing of people to Asia issue to the Korean unification issue. So, still, it's very important for us to to understand how we will use the rebalancing U.S. foreign policy in the responding to the unification is, because the unification is really important to Koreans, but it's also important for the Americans and also Japanese and Chinese, but still more important to and more compelling issues than to the Koreans.
Let me ask you a fairly blunt question. Is the pivot helpful for the ultimate goal of reunification, or are you worried about its impact?
As far as I understand, the pivot to Asia means that the United States think more about East Asia, Northeast Asia than before. Then the North Korean issue, the Korean Peninsula issue, should be means a lot, to the United States. So it is good to the Koreans and maybe to the Japanese and maybe not to the North Koreans.
So it's good for Seoul. All right, Gary, would you like to address the North Korea piece?
Well, everybody else has delved into history, so I'll just delve into a little bit. And that is that North Korea has been subject to U.S. economic sanctions longer than any other country. Cuba is number two, but North Korea is number one. So it's 60 years. And we have virtually no economic relations with North Korea. It's a medieval country, and I just love this episode where the nephew assassinated his uncle. I mean, the kind of things that go on there are just, they're kind of out of history books in terms of the way the country is run. The people are starved, all the things that go on, the luxury goods for the leadership, and on and on. So with that little bit of background, it really makes it difficult for President Obama or any president to kind of liberalize with economic relations or any relations with North Korea, because the last president who tried to do this, President Clinton, got pilloried for what he did, and you know, kind of the what he tried to do, and it didn't pay off politically in the United States, and didn't pay off diplomatically with North Korea. So, what to say about this? I know the United States is not inclined to listen to other countries, but on this file, my view is that the United States should just do what South Korea wants with respect to North Korea within the political limits in this country. Just follow what South Korea says is the best approach. Maybe it's tighter sanctions. You know, maybe. I'm not saying that we should bomb North Korea if South Korea comes to that view, which I doubt it will. But within the normal range of diplomacy and economic relations, I think Washington should be very guided by the South Korean leadership.
Thank you. Anybody else on the panel want to speak to North Korea, or can we go back to the history question? Did you want to talk about North Korea?
No.
Specifically? No? Stacey?
Just
we'll go. We are going to go back. Yeah, go ahead.
One quick comment about North Korea is obviously important to the pivot, and it's the one area where you see Japan, South Korea, and the United States having overlapping interests. The United States is increasingly concerned as North Korea is developing and fielding longer-range missiles, and its nuclear arsenal expands, and clearly Japan is as well. I also, from what I've heard from colleagues, is that the military-to-military relationship between South Korea and Japan is actually much better at the working levels than the political relationship, and it's sort of separate from that. And there might actually, to try to not be so gloomy here, be a place where there could be fruitful cooperation that is somewhat separate from the political arena, in that both Japan and South Korea are facing sort of lower level aggression, which you've seen with North Korean actions in 2010, and then Japan is obviously really concerned about what it calls gray zone aggression, this creeping salami slice tactics of China, and that they may be able to, at a mill-to-mill level, start to work on ways to develop an effective response to that that wouldn't be escalatory, but at the same time could deter further aggression and stop it from actually succeeding.
Thank you. I think we should go back to this question, and Chris started off with a question about what the U.S. role was, but I'm just going to comment both on the gentleman's comment and on Kathy's comments just briefly. I always get very nervous when people talk about a correct or proper history. I think whether you're liberal or conservative, you should be careful, because dogmas are dogmas, whichever side of the political spectrum they come from. And in most democratic societies today, history is a debate over what actually happened and the costs and the consequences of things. We don't necessarily have to rewrite the facts, because there are some facts that really aren't uncontested, right? They're acknowledged whether inside a particular country or across a broad spectrum of countries. But I would urge us just to be very careful about a right and correct history, because you're leading yourself down the path to eliminate other possibilities of contention. Now, diplomatic reconciliation is based on a legal treaty system, right? You negotiate between governments. Societies don't always recognize that negotiation represents their entire interest, and you can see that across the board, but particularly in the countries in South Korea, right, and that were colonized. You could see it in most post-colonial societies, frankly, that there's a rewriting and a rethinking and a reinterpretation of the terms of the independence or the post-war peace. That's what's happening today. Is it wrong? Absolutely not. But I think it needs to be acknowledged as such, that across Northeast Asia, there is a series of questions being asked about the post-war settlements, plural, right? So in Japan, yes, there are voices that question the terms of the San Francisco Peace Treaty. And there always have been in post-war Japan. This is not something that popped up. Mr. Abe is not the first one to articulate it. But he may be the first prime minister who's willing to acknowledge it, right? So Japan's post-war debate about its constitution is a very similar thematic. Why was that the right term for Japan's post-war? And should it be revisited today? And Japan will independently make its decision about whether that constitution stays or goes, is revamped or not revamped, but it is deeply embedded in this broader questioning of the post-war settlement. It's not necessarily anti-American or anti-Korea or anti-Chinese for that matter. But it is part of a questioning, and younger Japanese today are quite willing to raise some very pointed questions, not only towards the United States, but also towards their neighbors. And so some of that pointed questioning may come from the conservative right, but you may hear also some of it coming from the left in Japan. So I think we ought to acknowledge that this is not just about the Japan-Korea relationship. It is deeply about what is happening across Northeast Asia. Similarly in China. You know, we didn't spend a lot of time talking about domestic politics in China, but all of us here who speak to colleagues, who academics as well as others who come from Beijing and we go back and forth, we know that the question about the 100 years of humiliation in many ways is driving a larger conversation about Chinese identity today and the aspirations of new generations of Chinese. Will that raise or call into question the post-war settlement with Japan? Absolutely. Already has with the island dispute. And it will with us as well. I can't tell you how many Chinese academics and policymakers have said to me, but you created the San Francisco Peace Treaty. You created you being America. You created these problems in the region, and you ought to fix them. So getting me back to Chris Nelson's question, what is the U.S. role in this? I don't think, I wrote a piece when before the Hague meeting between Prime Minister Abe, President Park, and President Obama. I think in that particular case, and as you know, the United States government spoke out about the Yaskun Shrine visit, and I think that was the correct way for the United States government to respond. But the real question is a facilitating role, not a mediating one. And I do not think, and I, again, many in the audience may disagree with me here, but I do not think it's the American government's role to try to force upon either the Japanese or the South Koreans a remedy. And even if we could, and even if people, if government spokespersons did try to do that, including our president, I doubt that the South Korean people and the Japanese people would accept that role. So I think ultimately, in the deeper sense of what constitutes historical reconciliation, that's a project for the Japanese and the South Korean people. And I think our commentary on it only comes when we're talking about U.S. interests in the region. One place I do think the United States has a broader set of homeworks, frankly, is in understanding better its own role in the creation of the post-war order in Asia and not talking about it simply as a strategic interest or an economic interest, but in understanding better the way in which American choices affect perceptions of history and other countries' debates over that history. So I'll stop there. I realize Professor Lee, you wanted to add to that, I think.
I think Sheila has mentioned very important matter of why there is no historical reconciliation among the Northeast Asian countries. If you compare the European continent, I think Europe had a tremendous loss of life and casualties because of two wars. And I think with that huge price, I think they had a kind of historical reconciliation. And also because of cost and because of the postal efforts through the multilateral integrations and also very important role of Germany in that matter. But I guess in East Asia, in Northeast Asia, we didn't have that kind of chance. It was more like a liberation by the Western powers. And so therefore, we didn't have enough regional, more voluntary efforts to reconcile each other. So that makes why the 19th century themes of history and this obsession of sovereignty comes up again and again. So I think for that matter, I guess many Koreans and Japanese and also Chinese would advocate more multilateral cooperation to settle these historical issues from their own hands. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. We have 15 minutes left, and then I'm told I must shut down the conversation abruptly. So I'm going to get two people, maybe three people. So very persistent people with the same hand. So three more people, if you could be very brief, and then we'll come back to the panel to conclude. Gil Rosman?
I'm Gil Rosman, formerly of Princeton, now at the ASEAN Forum. And I have a question about the response to China's rise. I think that has been underestimated as the key difference between Japan and South Korea. And the specific theme here is South Korea's reaction to Japan's change on collective self-defense. And why does South Korea respond so negatively to what Japan is doing, and what specifically has Japan done, setting aside history issues, to offend China in its collective self-defense and to lead South Korea to say Japan is a cause of the problem of managing China.
Thank you, Gil. The gentleman here has been very patient with me.
Thank you for the microphone. For the last 20 minutes or so, much of the words were spent in answer to your question, Sheila Smith, about why now? And Catherine Moon gave an excellent answer, and I'd like to add a couple of points and then reinforce it. And then I have a question, and I'll try to be very simple.
For the audience, could you identify yourself for the audience, please? I'm sorry. Could you give your name?
Can you hear? Oh,
yes.
My name is Jay Pung Ru. I'm a retired professor of sociology of Loyola University, Maryland. I'm going to be serve as a chairman of a newly merged organization of One Korea Foundation with the International Council for Korean Studies, which will hence be called International Council for One Korea. Now, the why now? It's not now. It's been, as Kathy pointed out, has been here all the time. And why it has not been said before should be asked. That is, the Korea has been too poor to address issues like old sentiments that brood in history, too poor to address, you know, when stomach calls for your attention, nothing else matters, so they waited for that time. Second is, as Kathy pointed out, the democracy. Korea has been under military dictatorship up to 1987, and then another in-between years until the rise of YS Kim in 1993 election. So it's been scarcely about 20 years. And actually, questions should also be raised why Japan now is raising issue of the doing away with the old constitution and so on. And you will find similar answers too. Japan too has not had the reason to raise this issue, although it's been brewing in their minds for a long time as well. The other thing is that the recent development in the United States by the efforts of Korean Americans, and they find the world opinion is on Korea's side in the comfort women issue and the Dr. Island issue and naming of the Eastern Sea or others called Sea of Japan. We find that a lot of Koreans are interested in Germany, which is also divided, and they will find out more and more about why Germany was divided, how they got united, and what we can learn from their experiences. And we learned that we visitors to Germany not only see the Brandenburg Wall that's been demolished, but they also go to Auschwitz. They also go to Dachau and see how Willy Brandt came there and knelt and apologized. There's been nothing of the sort on the part of Japan. The Japanese didn't gas people by the millions, or maybe it's not easy, fair to compare. But the crimes were crimes, and the one of the most interesting phenomena is Michael Honda, the Japanese-American congressman, stood with the Koreans in many of these issues, and you can see why and how there are so many Korean-Americans supporting his candidacy, which is being threatened now in this year in November election, and how against a lot of Japanese-Americans the sabotage of him. So I think in the long run, it will be found that, after all, America was adversary in World War II and suffered terribly. And the guilt of having bombed the Nagasaki and Hiroshima made them mute. But a lot of American blood was shed. And that might have to be also addressed at some point. And in terms of United States attitude, a lot of Koreans now think this sort of a detente being established between North Korea and Japan is being done under the, United States is looking the other way, or at least under condonement of the United States. And if it is so, I think it's a mistake and they should try to. I have one question, though.
Please.
It's more important. We talked about United States, Japan, Korea relationship, and here we talk about South Korea. Think about United Korea and see how these triangular relationships will develop into what kind of shape into the future. United Korea is, in the minds of most Korean watchers that I know, is inevitable because of the unsustainability of North Korea in so many ways. It's been said that what is not sustainable will not be sustained. Only question is, will it be hard landing or soft landing or when? In the minds of most people, as far as I know, unification of Korea is one thing. I think the future of this triangular relationship will undergo great shifting and transformation once Korea is united. I think intellectual.
What would you like to ask the panel? We'll continue the conversation throughout the day, but if you could ask the panelists the question on your mind.
Whatever you have seen so far in terms of the nature of relations between these countries, with an eye on domestic politics, which is very refreshing to see. As a sociologist, I find that so.
Sir, I need your question.
My question is, how would you introduce what sort of variables to comprehend this one Korea that is going to inevitably come to be?
Okay, thank you. We have one last question. Thank you very much. We have one last question, sir, if you could be very brief, right there by the camera. We need to come back to the panel, and we need to stop at 11:30, so very quickly.
My name is Don Kirk. I've spent some time in the region. There seems to be an assumption here that there is a rebalance or a pivot. Can this really happen when we're plunging into a war in Syria and Iraq? Are you confident that will happen? Ms. Pettyjohn, in particular, would be familiar with the dispatch of thousands of U.S. troops from Okinawa to the Middle East, to Afghanistan, Iraq, and now possibly, you know, if not under this president, under the next president, to Syria and Iraq again. Do you think it's really possible to rebalance under these circumstances? I should add, not only dispatch of troops, but also aircraft carriers and planes and much else.
Terrific. Thank you very much. So we have three questions. I apologize. I'm going to be very succinct. I'm going to try to get you to be very succinct. So first question, why are the South Koreans reacting so strongly to the right of collective self-defense? Number two, what does a unified South Korea, unified Korea mean for trilateral cooperation between the United States, Japan, and Korea? And finally, is there a pivot? And if there is one, is it sustainable? So let's start. I think, Professor Huang, if you don't mind, I'll start with you. If you could be very brief on the unified Korea, since your paper was partly about unification.
excuse me. The baseline for the bottom line for the Koreans are the South Korea is still middle power, but the South Korea is still surrounded by the four great powers, the United States, China, Japan, and Russia. So even if the Korea is unified in the future, I also believe that Korea will be eventually be unified. Still, the Korea is still a middle power, you know, vis-a-vis to the other four great powers. So the expectation level and our situation would be somewhat different from those of the today's South Korea. But actually, still we have very similar, you know, the concerns and very similar, you know, the expectation about the future, the situation of Northeast Asia. So maybe South Korea's feeling about the other countries somewhat different, but still we may be, you know, concerned. We maybe will be concerned about both China and Japan, maybe to Russia. You know, the Putin is just, you know, more interested in the Far East. So unification is really important to Koreans, but I don't see many differences, even though the two Koreas are unified. But still, the Northeast Asia is already in the center place of the great powers in the future.
Thank you. So unified Korea is still going to want to cooperate with the United States and Japan. Is that right?
All
right.
Why not?
So Stacey, I'm going to turn to you on the pivot question. Is it sustainable? Are we even doing it? And what are the prospects for the future?
I've actually grappled with this a little bit myself and sometimes wonder how real it is, but I think it is actually real. The administration just sort of rolled it out in a way where they created unrealistically high expectations of what might entail, and therefore has reasonably not been able to meet them. The United States is a global power with global interests and is never going to focus exclusively on one region. And its forces are going to actually have to be able to move between the regions as crises emerge, which you see it happens all the time. And most of the U.S.'s forces are actually based in the United States anymore. There's very little forward in any of the regions. So I think the U.S. has also not gotten credit for a lot that is going on. The pivot or the rebalance is different. We're rotating forces. We're not permanently basing them. There have been plus-ups in Korea. We've sent another battalion, an armored heavy battalion, to reinforce the BCT there. There are attack helicopters, others. The rotations to Okinawa have gone up, not to mention what's happening in Australia and other places. Whether that's sufficient to actually stabilize the region is a different question.
Thank you. Gary, the question wasn't asked this way, but if you're sitting here in Washington, of course, the economic arm of the pivot is getting a lot of attention. Can we do it? Will our Congress be able to marshal its will, if you want to call it that, behind the prospect of a free trade agreement with Asia? Can you help us understand? Is it going to happen? And if it doesn't happen, what then?
Well, yes, it will happen, and you can, then if I'm wrong, you'll know it. I'm not going to kind of waffle on that question. I think Congress will do the right thing. I think President Obama will see this as part of his legacy, and he will really push it. There's even talk about pushing Trade Promotion Authority in the lame duck session. I'm skeptical there, but I think he will push it hard and we will get the TPP through. And I'm more skeptical about TTIP, but that's another day. So I'm optimistic. And if the U.S. were to fail, it would be a major failure, both economically, but politically probably more so. It would just be devastating.
Thank you.
But can I say something about the North Korea? This is, you know, if and when it happens, probably going to cost $1 trillion or more. And the question is, who's going to help the Korean unification? If it's all China, well, you know what that's going to mean for the geopolitics. And there's a big question whether the U.S. will be willing and able, and Japan willing and able, to step up and provide substantial, and I do mean substantial, money for what will be a very difficult project for a medieval country to come partway toward civilization.
Thank you. Professor Lee, I wonder if you could help answer Gil's question, that this comment that we have underestimated the impact of the rise of China on Japan-South Korean relations, and specifically, why are the South Koreans reacting so strenuously to the debate in Japan over the right of collective self-defense? Is it an overreaction?
I think I already answered the questions that the Japanese right for the collective security. I think they began to talk about this real support since 1998 when they revised the guideline. If they meant to support the U.S. forces in Korean Peninsula, if there is a war in the peninsula for the defense purpose of South Korea, there's no reason to oppose, right? That's very rational thinking. But however, our historical memory of colonization a century ago is still too vivid. So many Koreans feel very uncomfortable the Japanese army coming to the peninsula again. And second, if we had trust between two countries, I think it would be much easier to imagine that kind of a situation. However, that said, if there is a certain contingency, and if they come, I don't think there is no reason that South Korea is opposing, as long as they are helping the USFK. And I think because it's very unrealistic about the imagining Korea war in the peninsula, I think they are more concerned about the effect vis-a-vis China, because arming Japan, they think, is only creating added tension in Northeast Asia. So consider Japan's right for collective security as a destabilizing factor in the region. So we don't welcome them much, even though they have a right perfectly.
Thank you. So this panel has, I think, done an excellent job at talking a lot about both the impact of the changing geostrategic moment, but also in getting into the domestic politics, the aspirations And also the popular anxiety, I think, that is surrounding this particular moment in Northeast Asia. There is, as Kathy pointed out, a great deal of political opportunism across the board. And I think part of our job as educators and as the media, as I see a lot of media in the background, our job is to make sure that we don't let them get away with being very superficial about either causality or about underestimating the consequences of political decisions, particularly between Japan and South Korea and the United States. So with that, please join me in thanking our terrific panel.